I'm going to make this joke that I'm hugely impressed with Pauline using the only piece of technical equipment she used apart from the microphone was a glass of water. I'm afraid I've got a PowerPoint presentation and I've been travelling and that I just keep adding slides. I have a lot of slides. I think you'll like some of them. Oh, I can do. I can do PowerPoint. So what? I think it's hugely important to realize the creativity of living things and their imagination. I want to represent the child. That's why I like the child's curriculum being something that the child has an idea about, an intention for, or a feeling for. What I want to do is to talk about what we found by simply doing very careful of recordings. We are assisted by technology in infancy research because with the development of film and particularly cheap television, we have now got very clear evidence of what we all knew before we looked, and that is that babies are very sensitive, very clever creatures and capable of communicating from birth and almost certainly very human in their feelings before birth. And there's increasing evidence from very fancy technology, ultrasound movies and so on, that as Jonathan mentioned, he knows that there's a lot of new evidence that fetuses have intentional movements and that they're socially sensitive. If there's twins, they touch one another with respect and sensitivity, and also they show facial expressions of practically any emotion you'd like to mention, including a grumpy, bad-tempered face if there's a nasty noise outside. So they've got human feeling. Now, I just want to say, an acorn is an oak tree. At least it imagines it will be. And a baby, from conception, is a human being, is a person, not just a human being, but a person. And expecting particular things from a world that it is looking for. Sorry? It wasn't pressed. Okay. Expecting affectionate, playful human company and good food as well. Now, I like this picture very much as a picture of a healthy family with very few possessions. In those days, they had practically no technology at all, these beaver Indians. I just like very much the expression of health and affection of the parents and the pride and joy of the little girl who's wearing clothes that her mother made. There's a lot of tradition in what they have, and their culture is rich, but it's technically zero. But I think the only instruments they have are the tools that the father uses to hunt beavers. They don't have canoes. In those days, they didn't have canoes. Now, I'm sure the forests have been cut down. If their descendants are still alive, they'll be trying to run a farm with a broken down truck and so on. They'll have all sorts of problems with pollution and so on, things like that. Now, this is inquisitive human nature. The picture on the left, Enid Witham sent me that postcard. And she's the founder member of our group and a lot of other things, but I love the expression of curiosity and interest on the child's face, but also Charles Darwin is a nice little boy holding a bowl of flowers, which he, of his, and he did a famous experiment on earthworms too. I think that Charles Darwin does epitomize a kind of natural childish curiosity about the world. But he had an incredible modesty. He didn't think he was very clever, so he was patient enough to watch things. Unlike some people who rush in with a hypothesis and test it and publish it, 100 papers, and that's it. We like this weird painting by Titian, which shows in the Garden of Eden, giving the apple of wisdom to the mother, and Adam putting his hand on her shoulder saying, oh, we must regulate this. And I don't know quite what was going through Titian's mind, but I'm quite sure the church didn't like this picture very much. But it has all sorts of ideas implicit in it, including that meaning, and wisdom is in fact given through a child's initiative of contact and a mother's willingness to receive it. Now, Pauline has already made several comments about aesthetic and moral feelings, and I think I want to insist that my understanding of infant emotions is that they have very powerful aesthetic and moral feelings from the start. I mean, for example, it has been assumed by psychologists that pride and shame are complex emotions which have to be acquired through social experience. This is not true. I think even a fetus can look offended. There's one story which is not, I don't know quite the truth behind it, but in one of Suzanne Sadek's, in a film that was made for her, a woman was talking about doing drumming while the baby was inside her, you know, doing drumming. And the child came out like, with his hands over his ears. That's what she said. It's probable. Now, living cats, what I'm getting at, and this is an important point for our purpose in this discussion, I'm saying that the child has enormous resources of curiosity, morality, and aesthetic sense, and vitality and imagination, all of the things which we, no matter what profession we have, no matter what role we have in society, need to reflect upon as our natural heritage when we were children, and we also have to value what a young child can contribute without education. That means education is something that can cultivate something, but the thing that is being cultivated is much bigger, much richer. Lillian Katz said, we're doing earlier and earlier to children what we shouldn't do later. I think the principles of good preschool education should be practiced in the university. The university should not give high-powered technical instruction and practice with the use of the fanciest possible equipment. They should be places where people have enjoy discussions and discoveries curious together. I think the idea of a university is that it has no limits in curiosity. That's what it means. Now, I like this picture because this is a symbol of overprotective care of children. And I'll use this for example. I love the Giotto was very good on facial expression, especially eye contact. The baby looks skeptical and rather annoyed. And when I took in an a conference of audiologists, I said, why don't you take these wrappings off me so that I can move my hands? I can't hear if I can't wave my hand. The baby looks restricted and kind of annoyed. Everybody looks worried, too anxious. It's a shame. Now, I started work with Barry Berthelton in 1967 at Harvard, when there was a revolution occurring in curiosity about infants. And it was very strange because people started independently to look very carefully at mother-infant communication. There was no science of mother-infant communication at all before that time. Nobody had looked at that. But then several people independently discovered that babies were very clever at conversational engagement from very young. Well, that began many years of work doing longitudinal, that is, developmental studies following babies in situations where they were not being tested at all, but just given the opportunity to behave as they normally do, to chat with their mothers or play with their mothers. And we worked with mothers because it was the most convenient. In those days, the men were off at work and the mothers were with the children in the 70s. Now, one of my students criticized me very much for only looking at mother-infant communication. I said, it's just a matter of convenience, you know. And if we know something about it, we might know something about other communication. But what we did find was that the babies were very good communicators from the start. So, of course, they could communicate with each other. And he did experiments on babies in trios communicating with each other when no adults were present. And he found that they were extremely subtle. And they were like soap operas, what got into Now, we've divided the first 18 months into these in order to clarify what we see the initiative of the child developing into. In the newborn, we'll see in a moment, they have a lot of talents. They can imitate from the moment after birth, immediately after birth, although that was said to be theoretically impossible. They don't have a self, how can they imitate anybody else? Then, and after 6 weeks, because vision has done a very rapid development, there's not much to see before you're born, they start to become focused on their mother's face, which stimulates dialogue. And after 4 or 5 months, they get very playful and curious and lose interest in their mother looking around the room. This room would be very young. Compulsive interest for a 4 month old that's spending all the time with it in the light, counting it probably. And then the babies can be involved with the mother in a teasing game, a nursery song, or an action game by clapper clapper handies. After 9 months, there's a very dramatic change. It only takes a couple of weeks. The child starts to become interested in other people's purposes with objects. And it's given all sorts of names. We call it shared experience, taking the other person's interest as one that you could have yourself. And that does transform the things that they do, and it prepares the ways for that, but the way for naming things, it is the original source of linguistic reference. It is not derived from language in any way. The conclusion from this work, the overall conclusion, is that the baby is a person, seeking a good life, first in intimate friendship, then enjoying inventive games and with pretense, and finally informative for cooperative tasks in the shared material world, inventing meaning. You know, what is this gadget for, and so on. And pretending about it. Now, I think the word that I find most useful as a complement to the very popular word attachment, which is about affection and love, relation, and care, is companionship. Because I think even newborn babies want to have some fun. They don't just want to be looked after. And they are quite cheeky if they're given a chance, or if you pay attention. And they want to be joyful and proud without shame and fear of pain or loneliness. Now, this is human nature before school, and after 2, if all goes well, it can be reduced by school. Now, we've called it love, play, work, or we've been caused or encouraged to call it those stages by people who work in therapy. The very first communication is very affectionate and intimate and immediate. And then it becomes facetious, joking, teasing, and imaginative, and storytelling in a playful way. And then it becomes practical. And after the 9 months change, which is shown in purple here, the baby will want to use a cell phone. They actually maybe already very quickly learn to use it to answer the telephone, although they can't talk on it, or use other things. Now, so we've got, I don't need to go into all this, but what I want to emphasize is not only does the baby come with human characteristics, uniquely human characteristics on body and mind, but they have a plan of development. They have very, very clear age-related changes in their own development. They are not developed by the instructions they receive from the outside world. They join with the outside world in relationships, the physical world and the social world and the personal world of people. But they have their own idea of how they should occur and when they should occur. And each one of these changes is accompanied by emotional activity. In fact, they're called difficult periods sometimes because there is, in relation to each advance, there's usually a period of irritability, sleeplessness, bad temper, and so on. And what we realize now is that those unfortunate drops in conviviality and good behavior are just an internal process of getting used to new things, new ideas, new tasks. Now, Margaret Donaldson did very well with the machine. In 1978, she wrote a wonderful book called Children's Minds. And in it, she said, the human sense is understanding how to live in a human and physical world that children normally develop in the first few years of life. It is learned spontaneously in direct encounters with these worlds that arise unavoidably everywhere, transcending cultural differences. This just sounds a bit like what Pauline was telling you, we should aspire to. The learning is always informed and guided by emotion. That's, Margaret would say, a very, very important purpose in place. The feelings of significance, of value, of what matters. She's very interested in the fact that some things matter a lot to a child, or to anybody. Then she said in Human Minds, a later book, she got interested in the transitions towards skill and knowledge, and with the child's increasing memory and so on. She called it expanding locus of concern, from the immediate present to more and more extensive memory and imagination. And it's she has a very interesting philosophical summary about how the mind changes as you go into wider and wider realms of understanding until you get to the philosophy level, where you understand everything. Is that right? Well, she calls it transcendent. Anyway, she is talking about the difference between walking and belly dancing. It's quite obvious that to be a ballet dancer, you have to apply yourself. To play a musical instrument, to write, to do the kind of things that you learn when you go to school or in a special training situation. You have to work, and you have to apply yourself. I want to say that the baby has the kind of impulse to learn and to share learning, which is a very powerful motivation for that work. And Whitehead, in his philosophy of education, says that the primary thing in learning is the zest of the learner for knowledge, not the enthusiasm of the teacher for teaching. So he's again giving credit to a spontaneous process within us to become part of shared knowledge. And he says the paradox which wrecks so many promising theories of education is that the training which produces skill is so very apt to stifle imaginative zest. I don't think that learning is good at all if it makes you less imaginative, playful, proud, and convivial. That's a nice compliment. I mean, joyful. Now, just quickly, these are a bunch of different theories about education, and they all differ. These ones differ in the early stage. I'm very fond of Whitehead's Romance. That's a good one to begin with. Trust, Erikson's Trust is good too. Piaget's Sensory Motor, in a very limited reflex physiological sense, is plentiful. Bruner's Inactive One is more to do with activity and imaginative representation. This is his inactive, iconic, and symbolic. Is concerned with the acquisition of cultural symbols and cultural icons and so on. Now, Margaret Donaldson has point, line, construct, and transcendent as her loci of concern, meaning that she thinks that the baby is at first in the here and now. That isn't strictly true, because babies have imagination which takes the present into the future and into the past, already from birth, and they can recollect. Now, I'm going to refer to two Gifford lecturers. I think they both lectured in Glasgow. John McMurray distinguished, and he was opposing Descartes. He was saying that the self is not a thinker, the self is an agent doing things. And then he took, in the second book, it's called Persons in Relation. We are not only agents, but we are persons related in relation. Buber is a philosopher who is now, Vittorio Galizzi is one of the world's top neuroscientists and a philosopher, but he is working with the team that discovered these famous mirror neurons. he is using Martin Buber as a teacher. When he's, Martin Buber says that an I-you or an I-now relationship is fundamentally different from an I-it relationship with a thing. Now this again, this sounds very like what Claudia was talking about when she talked about you enjoy the joy of the other, you enjoy the love of the other, that you can love, and so on. Now that is more and more the language of brain scientists who are concerned to try to understand the relationship between emotion and action. One of the worst things about reductive psychology is that it's timeless and inert. It's purely factual and structural. But as I want to try to demonstrate it, if I get to it, I want to show you that the babies have an exquisite sense of time. Their movements have the same rhythms as those of an adult. And this means that they have an inner vitality that can resonate with or attune to another person's body movements very easily. This is Sherrington's gift reflectors, and he said something extraordinary. He said that the development of a fertilized egg into John Brown or Mary Smith is not an act of memory. It's an act of imagination. Now that is very much what I want to try to talk about. The child is an imaginary person, just the same as an oak, an acorn is an imaginary oak tree. They have within them not just potential, but the actual developmental principles that will go in that direction, given an environment which is suitable, I mean minimal even. Of course, the degree to which they will develop in harmonious and successful and enjoyable ways will depend on the quality of the environment. But the environment is not shaping something plastic. Plastic is the worst term to use to describe the brain of a child. And when we talk about vulnerability or protection, you know, we're talking about the child as if they're just weak and liable to be damaged by a horrible environment. We're missing something. We're missing the fact that what we should be doing is giving them every opportunity to show what the strengths that they have. And he said it would be imagination rather than memory. And he says the same applies to evolution. It's an act of imagination. Now, life is clearly always, in a plant or in a human being, expectant, seeking to know its effects, what will happen. It is creative and, if you say, in a sense, playful, because it experiments with possibilities. And an embryo becomes self-aware as its cells form a body. A fetus knows its vitality with first movements, aware of its own life and of the mother's or a twin's. The moving self of the child builds projects cooperatively with other vital cells in playful companionship. Now, I think play is an extremely important idea as important as life. Because play means doing things with imagination and risk, but also essentially doing things sociably. Play is a sociable activity. You can play by yourself, but you have imaginary companions. And you're very proud if somebody, a real person, comes along and says, oh, that's fun. It's shareable. Now, I'm very interested in the philosophy, the anthropology of play. I mean, and Victor Turner wrote about the human seriousness of play when he wrote about the nature of ritual and theatre. And this book has got very good quotes by Greta Fine. Pretense is charged with feelings as intense as those characteristic of attachment, and it expresses thoughts as intricate as those conveyed in language. This means that when a six-month-old baby can be fiddling with something, or playing with a mobile, for example, which can be induced to do. They don't need a mobile, but they can. A mobile is interesting because it's reactive. When you move, it moves, and so on. That's why it's interesting. And although divergent thinking is characterized by novel and original association, most theorists exclude bizarre or inappropriate associations from their definitions of the novelty and originality. Well, quite frankly, it's the bizarre and inappropriate which are the most enjoyable and often the most fertile. I'm sorry, Norton. Be good. children are playing with representations of their own affective knowledge. And then she proposes, Greta Fein proposes, practical knowledge and affective knowledge as being two levels of knowledge. And she's talking particularly about during the third year of life, says pretend sequences become increasingly marked by non-stereotyped personal inventions. Now, I'm fascinated with toddlers. Most of my work has been with babies. But I'm absolutely fascinated with toddlers because, first of all, they're so self-important. Hillary's laughing because she knows all about that. And son is declaring and declaiming and asserting his will at every opportunity in a most theatrical and absurd fashion, which he thinks is funny. He knows he's being an idiot. The other day, he was mildly censured, so he stamped out of the room and slammed the door. How dare you speak? But in addition to that, if you watch toddlers, they never just walk. They skip and dance or wiggle their bodies and do the ridiculous things. I watched a man running with his son. I think his son must have been under three, probably 2.5 or something like that, where he could run. And the man was running without looking at the child. He's running full speed. The child was keeping up with him. So its legs were moving like, and was it not only was it running, but it was doing things like that in the middle of the thing. Now, this is a very huge explosion of motor self-awareness, which occurs in toddlers. And it is not coincidental that it is the beginning of vocabulary. Huge surge of vocabulary. Words to name things is related to an enormously expanding sense of mobility, of capacity to do things. Now, talking about relation doing, toddlers have been studied by Jacqueline Dandel in Paris. And she has a great experiment where she puts them in a room with multiple objects. And she watches how they share the objects. They frequently pick up matching objects and imitate each other. And they end up, a group of three will be going around the room with black hats, sunglasses, umbrellas, and a ball in one hand, and something, they're all doing the same thing. One of them will put the ball down, and the others will all put the ball down and pick up something else. Now, she says, what do you get from imitating something you can already do? She said, sharing or interaction. You get some common feeling for doing the things. And not only that, they're very good at negotiating. This one is offering two balls. Here, you take one. And this one on the right can either agree or disagree. And they negotiate very strongly. I mean, they're really bargaining. But the point is to keep going this shared activity. Doesn't that resemble most of our careers? Now, this is a lovely picture of Barbara Rogoff's own children. She calls learning collaborative learning or intent participation learning. Intent participation means sharing the interests and purpose of the other. And these happen to be our own children, which is strange because those two little kids are twins. And Valerie, the eldest girl, is making a sandcastle. I think it's quite funny because the little boy looks like he's the overseer of the construction work. Whereas the little girl wants to be part of the action. They've got a different posture. This is the intent participation in action with a shared world. And of course, it's very interesting if the shared world has created possibilities. That is reduced with manufactured articles, of course. Things which are programmed to do certain things, to produce a silly joke if you press a button. We have to be aware that even though some very ingenious people have been making electronic media for little children,
and try to make them as imaginative as possible. They're actually bloody awfulness, you know, visually and so on, and they don't have any smell, and you can't feel them. Now, sand is completely different. It has all the properties that give you a reward for what you do with it, and it's slightly dirty, which is actually better. Now, in Mexico, three-year-old girls do something useful. They sit beside their mother, weaving on a loom, which is a small version of the loom the mother is using to make the dress patterns that the girls are wearing. And they form little collections of girls. And the little three-year-old is being helped by an aunt, who's only a 10-year-old. They assist each other and pass on the knowledge. And, of course, in quite a short time, they become skilled at using this to make cloth. Those kids go to school occasionally, or not regularly, and they call it paper learning, because they can't understand what they get out of it, because you don't make anything at school that is useful. Whereas if you're sitting beside your mother making cloth, you know what you're doing. Now, that's very interesting that school has reduced the evident, immediate usefulness of the products of learning and practice. Anyway, so Greta Fine again says that children's knowledge of ordinary events may be important in their daily conduct, but for storytelling or other narrative processes, it is their emotional meaning that makes events memorable and tellable. Well, Gerard Bruner, who set up, by the way, the Center for Cognitive Studies in Harvard, he was one of the trio who founded the cognitive revolution, which we're condemned to live within still. He and George Miller and Chomsky were involved in trying to make a science of cognition that would explain how the mind works. And they were using a metaphor of a computer. Now, Bruner, who's a very playful and disobedient person, even though he was the founder of that, had an enormous interest in cultural meaning and categories and so on, of understanding. But he decided that he would set up a project to study infants. And infants don't behave like computers at all. So he actually, with the research that began there, with Breslin and I were working there, and all the work that came out of that is incompatible with the cognitive theories of the mind. And because the babies are showing all sorts of capacities which are based on different principles, for example, emotional principles and motor principles. Now, one of the things that's important is that it also has led to the decline of the notion of a language acquisition device as a module in the brain of Chomsky. I like very much another joke of Bruner's, is that when he studied language developments in children, he said the language acquisition device, which was abbreviated to LAD, needs a language acquisition support system, a LAS. And that was his way of saying you don't learn language unless your mother talks to you. People, you know, you've got to have somebody who's going to share the words. You're not born with words, you're born with an interest in sharing words as reminders of things. But he also has gone on to talk a lot about storytelling. Storytelling intrigues us very much. Jonathan and I are interested now in collecting data from newborns that suggests that they have narrative imagination from birth, meaning that they can imagine a little story with an introduction, a development, a climax, and a resolution, perform it with their bodies, and receive acknowledgement from the mother, who joins in and congratulates the baby, or thanks the baby, and actually says, oh, that's interesting, tell me some more then. That's one of the most common comments mothers make to young babies. Why? Why on earth do they do that? It's because the baby clearly expresses an intention to create something imaginary, which takes time to develop. Now, toddlers are very, as I said, they're very playful with their bodies. They're also extremely playful with their voice. And Jan-Ole Bjorkvaal, who's been one of our speakers at one of these seminars, has done a lot of work as a musicologist. He studied the sounds children make in the playground, toddlers, and preschool children. He's looked at different countries. He has found, by the way, that big, powerful cultures, the children don't have as much fun in the playground. But small, rural cultures, the children are much noisier and more creative. And as a musician, he had been very interested in the range of musical sounds, and he calls them music, children's musical culture. Now, I mentioned Bjorkvaal because he's trying to set up an educational principle or policy in Norway. And he's been consulting with the Prime Minister of Norway about having a school, the principle of which is that it is devoted to creativity, not to teaching. In other words, it's devoted to the invention and discovery of meaning with the aid of skilled people. And he talks about the different levels. There's the child's level, which where the child's motives and feelings contribute. There's the local level, where the child is in relationship with the parents and with the community. And this is the one that is very sensitive to the physical environment. Living in a city with buildings of this type is very different from living in a village with buildings that are more organic, or living in a forest like those Indians. So the local resources for growing up can be enormously affected by technology. And then you have the national level, which is the curriculum. That's not the child's curriculum, that's the government's curriculum. And it's concerned with speaking well, literacy, reading, writing, and maths. That's what it says. Those things are tools. They're all potentially useful. Not everybody has to know them. Not everyone needs to be an author, or even a mathematician. Now, this is Jaap Pengset. Now, Pauline and I have different ideas about it. She thinks I'm seduced by the idea that there are physical phenomena, chemical phenomena. I don't believe that, but I do believe that this man has made more contribution to understanding the nature of motion than anybody I know. Not only has he done brilliant experiments on brains to find out what the chemistry is, so different emotional states are going on, he has found plenty of evidence that the emotional system of animals is the same as the emotional system of humans in important respects. And then he's written this paper saying that the primary emotional consciousness is a foundation for learning and also for tertiary and then secondary consciousness and tertiary consciousness, which is representational. And the title of the paper is very provocative. It says, the id knows more than the ego admits. The ego is more rational. Now, this is a diagram. Pengset and I wrote a paper on music and emotion. And we summarized our thinking about the function of his emotions in the relationship of the self, which is S, to objects, O, or to people, P. Now, all of these are his terms, seeking and exploring rage, fear, pleasure and pain, sexuality and social attack, panic, separation, distress, that is the squealing of a puppy or a kitten or a chicken or a baby when it's lost and alone, nurturance and maternal care, and up the top, play, joy, and social affection. Now, I've been interested for a long time in how does the mind and body together differentiate between persons and things. The main difference between a thing like a table or a motor car, even a motor car which is obedient to our intentions, you really can't have communication with it. Because you can't negotiate feelings of your imaginative animacy. With other people, you have to. You can't be conscious of another person without being conscious of their vitality and their presence and the way they're moving. And so I have said that there, I got this idea from the musician Theodorakis. He said, in ancient Greece, there were two rites. There was Dionysian rites, which lead to art, drama, music, and dance, where you throw your clothes off, run in the woods, and make love and drink a lot. That's what happened during the Dionysian rite. The Apollonian rites, to do with measurement, control, architecture, technology, and science. So that you've got these two things. On the one side, the left side of the diagram, your self is engaged with the physical world. On the other side, it's engaged with the interpersonal world. I think that you can call the emotions of relations with the person moral, all of them, and the relations with the physical world, and your action in the physical world has to be included, are aesthetic. It's not just the beauty of an object, but it's the beauty of the object in relation to your appreciation of it, which is related to how you can move. But the idea is that in any fertile and productive culture, you have to bring together these two things. Now, I want to get on to babies. You can have a look at, I mean, I can make these things available, but the idea is that culture requires a balance between the Dionysian and Apollonian principles. And the ones that are moral, the most important emotions are pride and shame, pleasure and beauty, and displeasure and ugliness on the other side. Now, by the way, I think a very important principle for any of us that are interested in teaching is that shame makes learning very difficult. Pride is a condition, is an emotion that supports memory and learning. Now, how much time have I got? I never know. Oh, how much time? Okay, I'll go through these quickly. I can make them available. I want to show you one film at least. One person who's revolutionized our thinking about infancy is the psychiatrist Daniel Stern, and he has recently written about vitality dynamics. These are shapes of expressive movement, how we move, not what we're doing. And in his first book in 1985, he published a book where he tried to put together new knowledge of what infants were capable of and psychoanalysis. He found it very difficult. They didn't fit. The baby was not a psychoanalytic baby. It wasn't just building up complexes with deep internal anxieties and so on. These are the words that he chose to illustrate his vitality dynamics. Adjectives and adverbs, which are very powerful in communication. We know, just like you just made a very languorous movement. We're very conscious of the style of a person's movement. You know, every arm movement has a cadence and a course of shape, which is expressive of feeling. We don't talk about it, we don't even pay attention to it very often, it's a bit impolite. But it's there as an undercurrent of our mutual awareness all the time. He calls them the child of movement, vitality dynamics. But this was very interesting. He got an enormous response from dance and music therapists, non-verbal psychotherapists. They said this book is talking about something we know, and the verbal psychotherapy is not grasping that. This is Nigel Osborne, who was our professor of music. He has done a lot of wonderful work in Sarajevo, in countries where there's been war, in Palestine and Uganda as well, where people have had terrible traumas as of the war, and he uses music. And his music students creating music with people. Some of the adolescents have had such terror that they are mute. One or two of those young people have become rock stars now. They've been liberated from their fear and that by music. this is Grassmanin. And he talks about them maybe as a person. The old model, pediatrics can't work very well. You don't assume that a baby is a person. You don't understand that the illnesses and you don't know how to help. It's a baby. Or the thing that, the point about that one is that, sorry, I'm going to go wrong. I might as well share, tell you the point that I was on that one. Oh, I know. I've got a problem which I haven't got. What I meant by showing that again was that the baby's brain is a third the size of an adult brain, but it's got all the parts that you need, except the hugely the neocortex, which is going to develop a lot. And I think the best metaphor for the neocortex is from Bjorn Merker. He says, the neocortex, this great big cerebral canopy on top of our head, is sheets of paper that were issued at birth on which to write our life story, but it's not the right. It's just a receptacle for experience. The really important processes and the motivating processes that use it, and they're active from birth. Now, this is a great picture I have to show you of a six-hour-old baby, the daughter of Ray McDonald, who is a Scottish saxophone player and music therapist. I think you must know him.
I do.
He was thrilled when his daughter looked like a conductor. But what she really looks like is a French chef who's made a perfect sauce. Everything, the fingers, the lips, the eyes. Newborn babies within half an hour of birth, can be very active. This one is tracking an object in a game, moving its eyes, its nose, its mouth, two hands and one foot to join the game. Now, I'll skip this. This is a two-month premature baby that has a dialogue with the father, with small sounds, which have the exact periodicity of normal speech. That is, the short sounds are separated by a seventh of a second, which corresponds to andante. And that is the normal frequency of syllables in speech. But they make a group of syllables that lasts about 5 seconds, like a phrase. And the last syllable is longer, which linguists call final lengthening. Because when you speak a phrase, the last syllable is longer than the others. So here's a two-month premature baby inside the shirt of the mother and the father, producing a linguistic phrase with the proper timing. And the baby is just as precise as the father. I won't play it over time. I do want to play this just to show you, to symbolize the authority of a child. I want to show you this 10-week-old baby lecturing her mother. And all her mother can do is move her head up and down. You'll see her mother's nose is there. And you'll hear the mother make some soft sounds now and then, but most of the noise is coming from the baby. I hope it plays. That's the mother. It's only 10 weeks old, and it's got quite a lot of authority. It's been bossy. Actually, at one point, the baby said, that, which is a consonant she's actually uttering, so that's not meant to come until 6 months. Saying, that, or ma, that. She says, yes, she does, she said, that. And now, this is the system that we've looked at for years and studied in great detail. It's very complex, involving all of those organs of expression, which are innate organs prepared for conversation, which are present before birth, and which become active immediately after birth and can join in dialogue. And maybe I can play 27 seconds. I'll play this part of the conversation.
Come on, again. Come on, heaven. Oh, yes, is that right? Well, tell me some more, tell me more, oh, come on.
Well, to cut the long story short, this is a pitch pot of that, and it looks like a wave going up and down. And Stephen Malick, who did the musical analysis of this, said it has a very, very clearly defined temporal pattern with bar structure and rhythm, and the melody respects the structure perfectly with very precise vocalizations at the right time. And it has an introduction where the mother is asking the baby to communicate, and then the mother gets excited when the baby responds, and then they get coupled together in the mother makes an utterance, which then the baby adds to, and then finally it comes to an end, and the baby makes two sounds at the end, goes, now I can't ever say this voice, but the point is the second sound is already going down. The baby knows the dialogue is going to finish. Then the mother finishes it with two soft sounds which go down to middle C. We found that middle C is the middle C of every baby. It's not put into babies for the piano, it's put into piano for babies. And our hearing system is designed for hearing and feeling in the human voice, and pitch is very important. Anyway, this is the same girl, Laura, 30 years later. And her father sent me a recording of her talking to her baby, and she said, I'm good. And I said, you've heard nothing in 30 years. That's exactly what she said to your father when you were recording it. Anyway, that's a book that has come from Laura's dialogue. And 27 Seconds has produced a very large book on the theory of communicative musicality. And I think, well, I'll just show you a couple of pictures to get capture the next developments. 3 or 4 month babies get self-conscious if you hold them up to a mirror, they look coquettish. And they become good at joking, teasing, and mucking about. And Vasudevi Reddy is the world authority on that. And has published an amazing book, How Infants Know Minds, about the development of their pretentious behavior and showing off and all of that, which they would get very good at if they're happy. Now, there's a Japanese boy enjoying his mother's. Now, I just wanted to tell you that we've studied songs from more than a dozen different languages. Baby songs have this structure, four-line stanzas, round and round the garden, like around a teddy bear, one step, two step, particularly on the bear. The rhyming vowels are very important because babies tend to vocalize with them, and they can learn them. The rhythm is andante, round and round. No, it's iambic, da-da-da-da, heel toe when you're walking. So it's round and round the garden, round the teddy bear, and then it gets menacing. One step, two step, and accelerator, tickling under there. And you'll see that in the tickling under there, the mother is enjoying it more than the baby. Then clapper, clapper, handies. And I want to finish with this because I want to show you the meaning of pride. This has the same structure. We've got songs from Japan, from Germany, from India, and all over the place in Africa. Emma from Craigmile was very good at clapper handies. And Nuchi was sitting at home on her father's knee. The mother was standing behind the camera. And the mother said, clap handies. So Emma showed it to the camera with a big smile. And it's just the same as the Queen's smile on the Jubilee. That's pride. It's a joy shared with somebody else of being appreciated. So you've seen this appreciation in babies when they get contact with another person for something they've done. And this is the kind of thing that knows, a teacher knows they've succeeded when they get that. Here she is with a stranger. She tries to make friends with him. He doesn't understand. She shows him clapper handies. He says, aren't you going to say something to me? She puts her hand on her head, are you crazy? I just showed you what I'm famous for. You know? And then she won't look at him and she claps to herself. But But shame is that babies look pretty unhappy when they're in front of a stranger. They clearly don't like being with someone that doesn't understand them. It is not just that the stranger is unknown, it is that they are stupid. It's a general rule, unfortunately, in human life, that strangers are stupid, because they don't have the same knowledge as you. And we've got to exercise great moral strength to be tolerant of people who don't have the same ideas as us. And babies are sensitive to ideas. By the time they're 7, 8 months old, they're very sensitive to rituals they play with their family. And if somebody comes along who's an idiot, they don't like it. And they feel ashamed, they feel bad in themselves. All right, what's this is baby cooperating after 9 months. Put it in there, and she's pleased with herself. But, and then she was reading, she was sitting on her mother's knee just after doing that. She pointed to the bookshelf and said, "Ah." The mother looked and said, "Oh, she wants the National Geographical. She recognizes it's yellow color and wants to look at the pictures." So I gave her the National Geographical and she looked at the pictures. That is a one-year-old, that's what they like. They already know it in a family that has books. They know about the National Geographical. And so on. This is a good example of a baby refusing to do what the mother said. The mother said, "Put the doll in the truck," and the baby held the doll out and said, "No, you do it." And the mother kept pointing to the thing. The baby said, "No, you do it." Or finally, she's sitting on her mother's knee at home and reading her book, and then she drops her book. The mother is reading the telephone book bill. Actually points to the telephone bill and says, "Don't I read over that," which is called jargon. And it sounds very critical, like you're spending too much on the telephone. So her mother gave her the telephone bill and she sat on the floor and read it. That is being cultured, you know, knowing about the importance of something that your mother thinks is important. And that's what begins at 9 months and starts the way to language. Anyway, I'll stop there. We've seen the same things in Africa. It's a little boy who's asking for his favorite toy and showing it to everybody. Okay, well, I'll stop now, but I'm trying to give you a flavor of the evidence, which is just observational evidence, not experimental evidence, but observational evidence of the creative enthusiasm of babies and their willingness to become friends and sharing meaning. And after all, I mean, anything we have to do about the environment, the ecology of babies, has to recognize and protect that. Great. I think my voice is conking out.